Well, the world is dumpster fire, and nothing here makes sense. And you pass it lit between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good, and you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today on the show, we have got hypnotherapist and author Norman Plotkin. This is a really fantastic show. I can't believe the incredible people who have been willing to come on and share their stories of hardship and triumph and inspiration. And this is no exception. I have had an interest in hypnotherapy ever since I was a little kid. I always found it to be fascinating. And I'm not talking about the fun aspects, like turn somebody into a chicken, or something like that. I'm talking about the actual practical applications, like people who used it to quit smoking or stop an obsessive thought pattern, things like that. I always found it to be something very fascinating. And so I've done a little bit of research on it, but not too much. And I was really happy to get some information from Norman throughout the course of the conversation. And like always, I got to remind you, I am not a licensed therapist. I'm not a licensed anything. I used to be a licensed investigator in the state of Michigan. I had a private investigator's license. How weird is that? But no longer. So any of the information contained herein is for informational or entertainment purposes. And that's it. That said, I think you're going to find a lot of things here. I sort of feel like even if I was a licensed therapist, you'd probably want to get that information verified if you're going to use it to change your life anyway. I'm just going to put that out there. I generally believe that maybe you shouldn't trust the things you hear the first time you hear them. Does that make sense? Whatever it is, wherever you're getting the information from, especially if it sounds awesome. If the information sounds awesome, do a little bit of research. It can only benefit you, make you smarter, make you a more interesting person for the more things that you know. You'll find out that you probably know a lot more than you think you do. Or maybe you think you know more than you do. And you should learn more so that you can catch up with how you feel about yourself. It's not my job to manage your expectations. This introduction has gotten off the rails, but it's positive. It's happy. That's something I can feel good about because I have not really felt all that great for a while. Now, last week's episode was my birthday episode. I did get some birthday wishes from some of you people, and I want to say thank you for that. That was really touching to get a happy birthday and to hear from people. It is weird that I always feel a sense of sadness around that time. And this year, I've decided that I'm done with that. I'm done with looking back on the previous year and looking at the failures, looking at the place where I'm not in life, and instead, I'm going to take some action for myself, and I'm going to recognize the things that I've accomplished and the things that I have yet to accomplish, and I'm going to move forward with a sense that even if I'm stumbling around in the dark, I am stumbling around much more confidently than I was even a year ago. So that said, let's get this intro over with and get into the meat and potatoes of this conversation, because this is a really, really good one. I don't know why I'm telling you that when I should just have you listen to it. So there are links in the feed below. There's a link tree for Norman Plotkin where you can find all of his various things, or you can go to normanplotkin.com. It's really that simple. And don't forget, you can always go to coffeeoversuicide.com. There are links to the store. Anything you buy in the store, I get a couple of dollars off of it. Most of the money goes to the company that actually manufactures this stuff, but it does help keep the lights on. Every little bit helps. So, enough plugging. Let's get into this conversation with the amazing, the wonderful, the charming Norman Plotkin. And hi, how are you today?
I'm great. Good to be here.
Well, so let's start here. First and foremost, right out of the gate, tell me a little bit about what you do and what made you decide hypnotherapy was a thing.
Yeah, I'm a hypnotherapist and I have a medical emphasis. I'm a clinical certified hypnotherapist. So it's the power of the mind, and that's what I was drawn to. It's a little deeper story that, you know, I'll get to, but mostly I see people for things that they tried everything else.
Mm-hmm.
They've been to everyone, and they've tried everything. They've done pills and doctors, and nothing seems to have worked. A lot of times they've been told it's in their head, and sometimes they present for things that they think it's about, and it turns out it's something else. So it's fascinating. I'm never bored, and I found a way to put myself into the service of others. And so why is that important? I was a lobbyist for 25 years, a staffer, consultant, analyst, lobbyist, and I love the area of public policy, but your politics is, you know, Ben Franklin said, if you like the law and sausage, watch neither of them made. It's ugly, and there's money and stuff, and it made me sick.
Yeah.
I had cancer, and it's never just about the cancer, difficulties in my life. My marriage didn't make it through that. All the material things that I had worked for were about to go away, and I knew fear for the first time in my life. And so I connected with a friend who she had gotten out of politics and opened a yoga studio. And she took me through therapeutic yoga for cancer and taught me how to meditate and learn about Ayurveda and eating and my dosha and eating for my dosha and basically the power of the mind. And so coming out of that experience and walking away from the caustic environment that I believed made me sick, I was looking for a way. I read Wayne Dyer's book, The Power of Intention, and it was my intention to put myself into the service of others. And so I asked the universe, I've got skills. You know, people have paid me a lot of money for my skills. I want to do it for people instead of corporations, associations, and politicians. And I was led to this amazing school in Los Angeles, HMI, which is the only nationally accredited college for hypnotherapy. And I did, it was about 18 months of schooling and residency, and I loved it. I had never, believe it or not, I had never been hypnotized before, and I signed up to go to school without having ever tried it myself. And the only thing I knew was the same thing that most people come to me with, the understanding they've seen somebody at the county fair or Vegas, right? Or, you know.
And when I snap my fingers, you're a chicken.
Yeah.
Like that.
Cluck now.
Yeah. So how do you get from, that's a lot of story in about 30 seconds. how do we get there? Tell me a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up first and foremost?
Well, I was born in Los Angeles, and I was fortunate enough. My parents moved us to the country in the Sierra Nevada mountains when I was 11, grew up on a 10 acre ranch. My first speaking experience was, you know, giving presentations in 4-H and then FFA, Future Farmers of America. So I was a very, very fortunate childhood. There wasn't a whole lot of work in that small little town in the early 80s, and I joined the Marine Corps and did a tour in the Marine Corps and got out, worked in the oil fields and in a rock plant like Fred Flintstone, making little rocks out of big rocks. And then I was a construction lineman for a while. And then my brother was killed in a car accident. And
oh,
it kind of woke me up. that I wasn't invincible, that it really was a wake-up call. And so I dropped everything, moved in with my mom, and started college. And then I was in a hurry, right? So
yeah,
I'm 25, and everyone else has got a head start on me. And so I walked onto a community college campus of 25,000, knew nobody, and just got right to it. I got into speech and debate, student government, did my associate degree in a year and a half, transferred to Sac State, CSU Sacramento, is where the government is. I had an interest in poli-sci, political science, and they call it government at Sac State. And I, first semester in, I got an internship as a clerk in the state assembly. And I managed to get 18 units of internship, and I've said I minored in experience. Of course, when I had my exit interview with the department chair, she said that'll never happen again. And so, like, not part of what being an insider is, right? So I got my bachelor's in 3 years, and I was on my way to law school. But now I'm working in the legislature, and I didn't need it.
What creates that kind of drive?
Well, I was a pent up hunger and underperformance for a number of years, and then inspired by my brother's death. That he was pre-med, he worked so hard in school, and I never had to even try. I've been very, very blessed with, you know, all kinds of gifts, and so I kind of dedicated myself in his honor and his memory, and I created this whole new thing, and it was a whole new life, and it was amazing, and it was fascinating, and I was very, very interested in all of the public policy and all of that. But then, you know, fate intervenes, and I used disease and sickness as a call. It's a call to action, and if you don't hear the call, it doesn't end up well. Right. Yeah. So I heard it. I heard it. I didn't hear the whisper, but I heard the call. And so I made significant change, and I love what I'm doing now in the service of others.
Well, paint a picture of your life, like where you were at, both kind of mentally and just as a human being when you got the diagnosis. Like, where were you at the day before, as far as, I mean, because there's life before cancer, and then there's life after cancer. And I have to imagine that there's some kind of a shift there, yeah?
Huge. So everything fell into place. I had material, things that beyond, and I began to not appreciate it. You know,
yeah.
It was just about acquisition. I had fast cars and a big house and, you know, all these things. And it's like a Talking Heads song, you know,
yeah.
Whose house is this? Right. It's like, and so,
yeah, exactly.
And I drank too much, and I ate unhealthy, you know, it was a train wreck. And
yeah.
So my body responded in that way. And so, initially, you do all the right things. I had been a lobbyist for the medical association. I knew a lot of doctors, and I did the right thing. I got a good doctor. I researched where he went to school. I got a second opinion. There's a lot they don't tell you. They measured my tumor for 3 years before they took action on it, and then I was four doctors in before anyone said cancer. And the only reason the surgeon said cancer was because he needed informed consent to remove my organ, right? So
yeah.
It happens quickly. It moves quickly. And I had never really been afraid of anything in my life, and really wasn't initially. I was going to, take this. Oh, you got the best kind, and it responds well to treatment, and it's well differentiated. And so I soldier on, and I go through. I have a radical thyroidectomy and lymph node dissection and a round of radiation. And, my ex-wife's family, she had lost her brother 2 years before, and then her brother-in-law, and she had lost her dad when she was seven. And these were the two men who kind of stepped up. So she was dealing with some stuff. And then I got a diagnosis, and it just complicated things. You know, 2 weeks after my brother-in-law passed away from pancreatic cancer, I wow. got diagnosed. And so it was a, you know, it was a big spitball. And so you go bravely into it. But, you know, this is kind of why I wrote my first book, which is called Take Charge of Your Cancer. You just, it's not very empowering just to go where you're told and to see, you know, who you're told to see and take the pill you're supposed to take. And it's not very empowering. So
yeah, it's kind of passive.
It's very passive. And, you know, I trust I had brilliant physicians. All, you know, my surgeon was amazing. My endocrinologist, you know, 3 weeks into my post-surgical care is diagnosed with leukemia. And it was just, and, you know, it was just one of those things. And so I made no lifestyle changes. I continued to drink, and I had a terrible episode. You know, in the post-surgical environment, I was hypothyroid, and I had a martini at a cocktail party, and it just knocked me for a loop. And then, you know, the emotional thing began to take its toll. That was July. By April, there was another scan. They said it would come back. And on my 48th birthday, I was radiated for a second time. This is when I began to experience fear.
Well, you know, what was your experience with fear like up until that point? Was that something that you had ever really engaged with?
No. I grew up, I rode bulls as a kid, you know, and I raced cars, and I was a Marine, and I just had no concept. And so when it comes back and you've done everything you know you're supposed to do,
yeah,
and it comes back, now it's serious. And now you know there's a thing called Curie radiation limits, and they can only give you so much radiation. And so, you know, what now? And so That's when I got a wake up call, and I connected with my friend Gene, who's a yogi, and I began to go inward,
yeah,
and meditate and deepen my spirituality. And these are all, you know, the 7 steps in the book that I wrote. These are the things I found my way to on accident, through much trial and error, the hard way, as they say.
Yeah. A lot of people don't really find the things that they need to find until they really need to find them. And it's unfortunate, but it also happens to be true in a lot of cases. I mean, you're a human being who's sort of built yourself up based around the story you're telling yourself about who you are. And you tell yourself that story all the time. And it, like you said, you amass all of these things that are supposed to be the checkboxes for happy life. And, you know, you've never had to engage with your fear before. I mean, fear is there to teach you something. So all of those things, it's not really that big of a surprise in hindsight. But it seems like a big surprise before it happens. It's pretty interesting the way that we just kind of bumble around going, I don't know, maybe this. But then how do you go from yoga to hypnotherapy? Because there is a pathway there, right? There's some connective tissue.
Yeah, as the saying goes, when the student's ready, students appear. I mean, when the student's ready, teachers appear.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to write about my experience, but, you know, again, fate. So I moved to LA to change up the scenery from Sacramento, and I get a job as an executive director of a trade association. And they hire me to address, you know, some of the issues. They had some tax issues, and they wanted to be brought into the 21st century and updated and professionalized. And so I went to work on all of these things, and at the end of the first year when I started, I fixed their taxes, I built a new web presence and building their membership. And then I went to work on their ethics and touched a hot button and they didn't renew my contract. So here I am now and I'm in LA and I don't have a job and like, now what, right? So that's when I began again that self-study at Carolyn Meese, Wayne Dyer, Hay House. I went to a Hay House conference in Pasadena and saw Wayne Dyer speak and Carolyn Meese and Joe Dispenza, Dr. Joe Dispenza. And this is when I began to, through meditation and inward introspection, ask myself, well, what is it I want to do? And how is it that I want to go about putting myself into the service of others? And that's when, again, fate. I was in Los Angeles and here's this school. And it turns out I knew someone who had gone to it and we had dinner and we talked about what the experience was like. And I just jumped in with both feet. Now, I mean, the power of the mind. So think about it. I had gone from the bravado, the false bravado of I got this, you know, I'm going to soldier on through this cancer, to the fear that came up when it came back, to, you know, I had to focus my mind. And then going inward, it was a progression of the powers of the mind and writing a new story and creating a new set of identity, a new identity. And can you do that? And how do you do it? How do you go about it? And so the power of the mind, I was fascinated by it. And then, of course, you read Joseph Murphy, the power of the subconscious mind. I mean, literally, I've read a ton of books. I did a lot of research as a consultant and as a lobbyist. And so now the research, instead of, helping others, it began to be focused on me. And it was okay to rebuild myself. And well, it turns out, as I studied hypnosis, as a lobbyist, I was engaged in conversational hypnosis all the time. Milton Erickson was a famous psychiatrist, and Ericksonian hypnosis is very conversational. And oftentimes you just bore people to death with long stories, or you dive off into the bunny hole, and they're like, why is he saying that? And that's when they begin to escape, and they become suggestible to you. So it turns out, as I learned hypnosis and hypnotherapy and that neuro-linguistic programming that I'd been engaged in it all my life, way back to when I was a kid on the ranch and I was around cowboys who were of a storytelling tradition.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. With being a lobbyist as well, I would imagine that taught you a little something about perseverance and not necessarily failure, but failure of a sort. The idea of getting in front of people who maybe vehemently even disagree with you, and you're trying to make a case, and sometimes it goes your way, and sometimes it doesn't, and you have a responsibility to brush that off and keep going. Did you pick that up from somewhere earlier than that? Or is that something that you just sort of had to learn as you went by virtue of the things you were doing?
Oh, I like to win, and so it was a tough lesson. One of the toughest lessons, and one of the things that led me to such dissatisfaction in the end, is that I've studied hard. I worked hard. I made an argument. There's Norm. He's making an argument. But the other side shows up with more money and you lose. And so that was a bitter pill to swallow.
You can't argue with more money.
No, you can't. And the elected officials put themselves up on the rostrum and they look down on you and they can be arrogant. And I was a Marine.
Yeah.
I tangled with a few, and not disrespectfully, but we all put our pants on one leg at a time. But yeah. What was tough was that I represented underdogs, automotive aftermarket against the big car companies, electric service providers against the monopoly utilities, small oil against big oil, and all of them against the big state that has a ton of regulations that just, in California is highly regulated. It's very difficult. And these were mom and pop shops and associations who pulled their money and I wanted to win for them. And they, and the little bit of money that they put together in their political action committees, I was very, very conscientious about how, you know, I spent their money. And so, yeah, I mean, it was difficult, and there were disappointments, and you relish in the wins. You work super hard so that you can experience them, and you got to dust yourself off. You know, the thing is, it got so predictable. I had a guy, he was a trade journalist in D.C., and he called and he says, "So how do you think this, you know, that it was on the electricity and was restructuring, they were trying to undo restructuring after the crisis in California." He says, "How do you think that speaker's bill is going to go?" I said, "Well, it's going to go like this. It's going to get off the assembly floor 46 to 31. He says, you know the vote? I'm like, "Yeah." There's 48 Democrats and two will be absent that day. And there's 33 Republicans and two will be, you know, will take a pass because they're in tight districts, and it's going to go out, and it's the speaker's bill. So it's going to be close party line minus the one or two on each side. He says, can I quote that? I said, "Sure." He says, "Can I run it and call it my own?" I'm like, "Absolutely. You go ahead." So he ran a
better you than me.
He ran a story and it was exactly as I predicted. The vote was exactly as I said it would be. And he said, he called me that day. He says, "My phone's ringing off the hook. They wanted to know how I would know." And it just became so predictable. I was, you know, I got sick of it.
Yeah. What were the conversations in your household as far as any mental health concerns? Were there any conversations about mental health growing up?
No. Are you kidding? My dad was in World War II. My mom was a depression kid. You know, we didn't talk about stuff like that. And yeah. Even though my dad was a teacher, my mom, you know, marched in Mississippi. And, you know, so I'll tell you when the conversation about mental health were most important. My ex, she lost her brother and her brother-in-law and her dad. She went and saw a provider who gave her pills. She was on anti-anxiety, anti-depression, and Xanax on the side, eating them like Skittles. Off-label to sleep, you know. And she completely dissociated, you know. And she became someone who I didn't even recognize. And I wish I'd have known. I write about it in my book. I wish I'd have known that I wasn't the only one who needed help. And when, you know, and I went to my doctor when my life is falling apart and I'm fighting for my life and the life that I knew and I thought I loved was falling apart. I was going to lose all my stuff. I go to my doctor. I said, "I can't sleep." You know, he says, "Well, you have PTSD." I said, "You know, I don't like the D part. I think that anybody who's gone through what I'm going through can reasonably be expected to have post-traumatic stress. But I don't have a disorder. There's nothing disorderly about it. It's very orderly. I experienced this stuff, and I'm traumatized." And he tried to give me these pills, and I look at the box, and it's on the side of the box. It says, "Side effects are you may have thoughts of suicide." And I said, "Take those back. I'm not going to take something that may want me to kill myself."
Right.
And there was a moment. Let me just tell you, there was a moment, given, you know, a poignant moment where I chambered around, and I thought. And then I thought better, and I moved on.
Yeah, that's a rough conversation too, as far as the medication is concerned, because I tend to be in favor of trying everything else first, because the medication is something that can have a profound effect on certain people, but there are certain people it can just make everything worse. I can definitely say that the different cocktails of medicine that I've been put on in my life, there was a time, it was probably around 2004. I'm a young husband, a young father, and I realized one day that the house could burn down with everyone in it, and I wouldn't care. I wouldn't feel anything. And the fact that that didn't fill me with horror told me that something was wrong. And so I went and saw a therapist and I said, "Hey, I think I'm going to stop taking the pills, but I would like to still keep seeing you to talk, to make sure that I'm, you know, kind of where I need to be, because I do feel like I have some things I've got to work out, but I'd like to be able to handle these things as they come with just coping mechanisms, tools. I'd like to understand the misfires that are happening in my brain so that I can work with them instead of trying to work against them. Because it's all me. It's wiring. Some of it can be rewired, and the rest of it I hope can be managed. And that was luckily where I landed. But I do know a lot of people that were more or less okay and then didn't make it out alive after medicine. And that's a hard one. That's a real hard one. I've been pretty well managed without medicine for about 15 years before I started taking an antidepressant again for kind of a momentary situation. And then I weaned myself off of the antidepressant and started working on some different tools. Cognitive behavioral therapy has been really helpful. And I imagine that there are some similarities between cognitive behavioral therapy and what you do. Can you speak to any of that?
Oh, sure. You know, listen, depression was one of the side effects of papillary carcinoma that I had. And when I would tell family, friends, and they'd say, well, go out and get some sunlight. Like, are you kidding? I should just go out and get some sunlight?
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, I was a hockey player and I didn't want to go play hockey anymore. I raced mountain bikes and I didn't want to get on my mountain bike. The things that lit me up were so, absolutely. So my scope of practice requires me to do hypnotherapy. I'm not a psychologist. I'm a clinical certified hypnotherapist.
Sure.
But in the cognitive portion, I coach people, before I take them into the chair and take them into hypnosis and connecting thoughts, feelings, and behaviors is super important. Reframing their story is incredibly helpful. So the same thing that made me a really good analyst, policy analyst, and lobbyist makes me a good therapist, hypnotherapist. So I listen reflectively. And I go deep into their history and their childhood and their experiences. And I look for dots that I can connect and help them understand their experience. And oftentimes they're like, why didn't I think of that? It was so obvious. I'm like, well, listen, you're too close. You're too close to see it. And they seem unconnected. But so I spend a lot of time helping people reframe and understand the connections, because listen, if you listen to Dr. Joe Dispenza, he's great about, you know, making change in your life. If I ask you, why do you do that? And you say, well, 20 years ago, this happened.
Yeah.
Well, memory is completely unreliable.
Yes. Right?
You don't remember the details. In fact, you would recount them wrong. What you remember is how the experience made you feel. You see, thoughts are the language of the mind and feelings are the language of the body. So you remember how it made you feel. And feeling is, there's a chemical reaction that creates an emotion and that gets imprinted in your body. So I ask you, why do you do that? You say, well, 20 years ago that happened to me. So now I can predict the way you're going to act based on, so you're living a predictable future based on an unreliable past, which is robbing you of your precious present moment. Now, see, when you set it up that way, people begin to see things differently.
Yeah.
And I teach them about their automatic actions and their automatic thoughts. And I teach them simple things like the Four Agreements and the Reader's Digest version of the Course in Miracles, which is love is your birthright and it resides in your heart center. And its opposite is fear. And at any moment, you can turn fear into love.
Yeah. But that's not an easy thing to do immediately unless you get a little help sometimes, especially if you're a person who's pretty hardwired with anger.
I did my work on anger. I really did. And You're right, but it has to be pointed out to you. We're not taught the, I mean, this should be more universally shared, right? Yeah. So that you know that it's within the realm of possibility. And then, you know, because of the, you know, the many teachers that showed up for me, Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, you know, in this, there's in between stimulus and response is a space. And in that space lies your power because you get to choose what kind of human being you want to be. And so what I do is remind people, first of all, you know, it's not your fault. And second of all, you are powerful. And you're powerful because you get to choose. Now, on one hand, that's a great deal of empowerment. On the other hand, it's a great deal of responsibility. And so I just put that to them, though, that they have a choice between love or fear, and that they don't have to automatically respond right away to anybody. They can take a moment and think about who they want to be in that moment. And then they have to take responsibility for who that is. But see how you're connecting thoughts and behaviors and actions, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that's the triangle from CBT. So what I want to do is remind people how powerful we are. Disempowered in modern society, we're disempowered. We externalize everything to someone or something else. And it's created a host of victims and a host of victim behavior. And so I don't want to emphasize that. What I want to emphasize is that to resist externalizing and embrace empowerment.
Well, I mean, that's all just the best stuff. Figuring out how to make your reality a new shape based on the stories and the choices that you tell yourself, the things that you fill your intention with, and the ability to reconcile the fact that you don't necessarily have to focus on your control over an event, but your control over your response to an event, because they're all neutral.
Exactly. It only has the value that you assign it. Yes. The world is neutral.
Yeah.
It only has the value that you assign it. And look how powerful you are now. Now you can assign a value of any person, place, or thing. I have a routine that I do a lot with in the first few sessions, which is called Garden of Your Life. And I take people into the garden of their life, and I do, you know, big visualizations and hypnosis and visualizing great minute detail. And then I have them see a blanket of old crumpled leaves on the ground, and I have them visualize a rake and grabbing the rake, raking it into a big pile, and, you know, visualizing each leaf as a person or an event that hurt them or no longer serves them, and rake it into a big pile and light it on fire and see the smoke, smell it, the ash, and just see the calm smoke go up and be ridded from your life forever. And now then I transition them into some empowerment and then visualize the passage of time. And now it's spring and we're going to plant some new seeds, because whenever you remove something, the universe says you must replace it with something. And we plant some new seeds. I have them visualize what fruit they want to grow on those trees, and that they care for the seeds and water them. And they're just under the dirt. You know that they're growing and they're going to take shape soon and bear fruit, and that is the imagery of writing a new story. Because if you say, well, let's write a new story, they're like,
yeah,
I don't want, you know, what story am I going to write?
Yeah.
Right? So you got to use your imagination. And
it's a difficult process to recognize when, I mean, especially when you're in it. Like I had a long stretch of my life where I was telling myself that I had to be stoic based on all of these external forces that were crushing me down. And the story that I was telling myself was that I was built to survive it. But I was telling myself all of these negative things, like the world is crushing. I'm surviving, not thriving. I'm getting by. I'm not happy. And I saw this kind of, I don't know, it was like my version of manliness involved in all of that. And it took quite a while before I realized that's what I was doing. And so for you, as far as coming out of the depression that had manifested itself after the cancer, what was that like for you as a person who hadn't really had to feel that before?
Well, I didn't spend a lot of time there. I recognized that there was a moment when it was crushing. Yeah. And, you know, I told you the story about go out and get some sunlight. I'm like, shut up, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, so I just, I redirected myself. I'm on my like fourth life in this lifetime. You know what I mean? You know, the Marine, the oil fields, the student, the government, the, you know, the legislature, and now the hypnotherapist. So at any rate, I got super excited about what my next, I asked the universe for help. And then I surrendered to the universe to allow. And then I wrote my book. And it was a cathartic release. And my, the book is on Amazon. I got a bunch of 5-star reviews. My son was 14 or 15 at the time. And he saw a 5-star review. And he screenshot it and he sent it to me. And it was by this woman who bought it for her mom who had breast cancer. And she was so grateful. And what a huge opportunity it gave me to respond to my son. I said, you know, thanks for sharing that. If one person is better because I wrote this book, then the whole cancer was worth it.
Yeah. But that's an insight that you're very lucky to have.
Agreed. But here's what I hang my hat on. Little stories like the boy who walked down the hallway to his room and opened the door to his room and it was filled with horse poop. And you know what he replied? There's a pony in here somewhere. You see, and that's, I just decided one day that's it. Just like one day in my 20s when I was really not happy with myself because I couldn't find my keys one more time or I couldn't find my wallet. I'm like, I am never going to not know where my keys and my wallet are again. And yeah. I made a contract and, you know, I'm strong-willed, make no two ways about it. I'm strong-willed. So not everybody can, and I appreciate that, but I would encourage them all to try.
Yes.
And I mentioned early on that the gifts that I've been given, my intelligence and my strong will and my perseverance, and that's why. And so now I've come into my soul's purpose, which is to help people. And so now instead of listening to respond and beat you with rhetoric, I listen to serve and to help.
Do you have compassion for your younger self when you think back about, you know, the other lifetimes that you've experienced, the other person that you were? Are you able to look back on those things with less judgment, more compassion?
Oh, of course. I cringe sometimes at some of the things I said and did, but that's okay. That's okay. I look at... You know, there's a lot of people, they scratch their head and they look at me and all the things I've done. And I have friends who've sat in the same desk for 25 years. And I have a stack of business cards that are as tall as he is. And he doesn't get me. And I don't get him. But, you know, no one's ever going to say at the end, when I do cash in, you know, that Norm, you just, you know, sleepy Norm. You know, it's just I'm going to slide into home plate. You know, I've got plates and screws and scars and surgeries. And I'm going to be used up and I've got a lot to give along the way. So these are the things that I made a contract and it's taken 6 years to build my hypnotherapy practice.
Yeah.
I just wrote my second book. I published yesterday and I'm super excited about it, but I wrote it in January, February, and it's taken me to now to get all the paper cuts done, you know, all the million little details of publishing stuff. So it's just, I made a contract that I am here to serve and that my highest purpose is to serve. And that I wanted to call my first book, The Unwrapped Gift. Just like I view my brother's death as an unwrapped gift. It may sound strange, but it breathed new life into me. I had a little guilt over that during certain periods, but I'm lifted by him and his memory and reminded that was my unwrapped gift. And so my publisher said, you know, Norm, cancer probably was a gift for you, but how long did it take you to figure that out? And I'm like, yeah, it was a few years. She said, you got to meet people where they are. And if you're writing a book for people who are in the middle of cancer, they're not seeing it as a gift. So instead, you know, it's for men who want to do something proactively when they're in the middle of it, something, seven things that they can do that are empowering. Right. And so, but it was that, it's that empowerment. It was the unwrapped gift. And now the second book, and now it's no longer a fluke. Now I'm starting my third book, and they're all books that are going to help people and change their lives. And I was frustrated when I couldn't drive a lot of people in my door to help them, you know, and I had to learn that I can't help everybody.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, I had to learn tough lessons that before you help someone heal, make sure that they're ready to give up the thing that made them sick.
Yes. And, you know, this,
right. There's tough lessons along the way, but the contract was that I'm going to be in a place of love and in service to others. And this is my soul's purpose and my highest, best good.
Yeah.
And so on those days when you're down, that's what just carries you through.
Well, the people that you're trying to help, and even the rest of the world for that matter, they're going to do whatever it is they're going to do. But who are you going to be? That's really the only thing that you've got any control over. You've got a series of tools that you can lay out on the table and make recommendations. But as far as getting people to accept the tools, to start carving away, that's on them. And that's a tough thing to come to. I was institutionalized twice when I was younger for suicide. And it was the second time that I understood that it was me that had to do the change. It wasn't the pills. It wasn't the doctors. It was me. They were there to throw things at me to see what I was willing to catch. That was the thing. I was like, oh, right. It's not working because I'm not doing anything. I'm not making any changes. I'm not changing my behavior. I'm not changing the way I look at the world. And it's a process. And it's a process you have to be willing to forgive yourself for when you fuck something up.
So true. It's so true. It's and you have to be kind to yourself. And that's part of the love in your heart. Not it's not enough to be kind to others. I was really hard on myself.
Yeah.
And what you know what that led me to be? Hard on others, expecting them to hold themselves to the same standard that I held myself.
Absolutely.
And all that made me was an asshole.
Yes. Yeah. And it doesn't matter if you're right. Being right doesn't, there's a way to be right. And then there's a way not to be right. Being right is not everything.
No, I've learned to lead others to be, you know, help them, you know, Socratically, let them find it on their own, plant little nuggets and, it's just, and just to share my light. That's what, you know, Rumi says the cracks are where the light comes in.
Yeah.
You see, there's all these ways to reframe everything. And that's, I've just become the master of the reframe for myself included.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to read the books. I'm very excited to start digging into this because this is something that hadn't ever occurred to me before, and now I want to go down the rabbit hole and find out everything. So thanks for sharing this with me today, and just thanks for talking to me.
You know, I really appreciate the opportunity. There's a story here, and the lessons that I learn are made real and valuable by the ability to share them.
That's perfect.
So forever in gratitude.
Oh, can you believe it? Forever in gratitude. What a great way to end this show. Gratitude is the most important thing that I can think of because there are a lot of dark clouds ahead, and literally right now, there are dark clouds up in the sky, and it's raining ash in a lot of places, including here in California. I hope everybody out there is staying safe, and if you want some more Norman Plotkin in your life, and I know that you do, just go to normanplotkin.com. It is that easy. You can find links to all of his other sites. All of his other things are everywhere. There's a link tree in the feed below that you can go to. And I am going to have some music news coming up. As you remember, I recorded a show back in February, and it'll be coming out soon. But until next week, don't kill yourselves out there.